Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we'll hear from the producer and host of Deconstructing Dinner, a podcast, radio, and online television series, and the author of Grocery Story. But first, KWGS News Director John Durkee gives us an update with the latest on last night's severe weather, the effort by the Corps of Engineers to move this huge volume of water in our area lakes downstream, and the impact that's likely to have on Tulsa and other downstream communities.
Well, the big issue is going to be the amount of water that is flowing into the Arkansas River. And just about a half hour from now, the Army Corps of Engineers will be increasing the amount of water flowing into the river from the dam to 250,000 cubic feet per second. The river channel can handle about 110, so we're going to have serious flooding throughout the city of Tulsa. There has been some problems with the levee system, as you heard just about 45 minutes ago in a news briefing on KWGS. The county commissioner for District Number 2 and kind of the head county commission chair this year is Karen Keith, and she talked about some of the problems.
We have what's called a sand boil. It's at East 81st West Avenue. Everybody is working on it, and we expect and anticipate that everything's going to be fine with that. I would also say that as the water sits on the levees, the longer that duration, the more risk we have for failures. But we are amping up all eyes on the levee to make sure, as if we have any issues, that we are on it immediately. As you just heard, some of the neighborhoods along the river, now many of them have water in those homes, and with the anticipated 250,000 cubic feet per second heading their way, we know that they're going to take on a whole lot more water and more of the homes will be inundated. Power is about to be cut to Meadow Valley and Town and Country. We are also checking. I thought the Tulsa Boys home was fine. It's up on a hill, but they're right. Meadow Valley is right below them, so PSO is trying to check on their power situation. They're already having to bring in porta-johns, so it might be possible that we have to move some of the boys. Some of them have been sent home.
That is Tulsa County Commissioner Karen Keith discussing the flooding situation in a briefing just a few minutes ago. And again, the biggest problems that we do have, flooding will be taking place on Riverside Drive as well. Because of the flooding, this is Mayor Bynum.
The impacts on Riverside Drive, and I'm going to encourage folks, if you don't have to drive on Riverside, please don't. There are other streets that you can utilize to get around town that aren't going to be impacted by this in any way.
As the water flows downstream, there are problems in Bixby as well. Lots of folks being evacuated there. This will eventually make it all the way down to the Fort Smith area, but first it has to go through Muskogee, where they have problems this morning with flooding there, as well as Weber's Falls. We'll keep you updated and informed here on 89.5 KWGS.
Today on Studio Tulsa, have you ever gone to the grocery store, bought fresh produce, and within a day or two watched that food go bad? Well, that's generally due to the very long supply chain that's common in 21st century supermarkets. My guest today advocates for a local food-based economy that provides fresh food from food co-ops. John Steinman is a Canadian food systems journalist and producer and host of Deconstructing Dinner, now a television web series. It was originally a radio show and podcast. In his new book, Grocery Story, Steinman deconstructs the food retail sector and how that affects food prices and farm prices, and advocates for food co-ops, a locally owned store as an alternative to the chain grocery store. For over 10 years, he's been a director of the Kootenay Co-op in Nelson, British Columbia, Canada's largest independent retail consumer food co-op. Today, there are over 300 locally owned consumer co-op markets in the United States, and more are starting every day. Steinman joins us to talk about this alternative to the traditional grocery store. John Steinman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on your show.
Your book, Grocery Store, is the culmination of a lot of work over a number of years trying to understand and examine the Canadian and American food industry. We should mention you were from Canada and British Columbia, where you've actually been a director and president of a consumer co-op. You're also looking at how grocery stores affect communities, consumers, and agricultural producers, contrasting that with local co-ops and local consumer food buying opportunities. So what is the takeaway from this examination? Are you looking at co-ops being the next realm of a way for consumers to buy their food?
I think so. And, you know, you say next realm, but, you know, it's a model that's been around for well over 100 years. And but certainly it hasn't really spread to the point where we can find a consumer-owned food cooperative across the country just yet. And so part of my motivation with the book is to, you know, introduce this idea for communities, to remind people who are in communities that have a food co-op what that co-op is and what makes it different. And so I do think it's really the answer, I think, to a lot of the challenges that more and more of us as eaters are becoming aware of, like the challenges of accessing good food in our communities, which in some cases is because there aren't really any local grocery stores anywhere near us. And in other cases, really trying to access the foods that we want to see, whether it's local foods, more natural foods, organic foods. I mean, these are some of the reasons why food co-ops are forming. And I think a big part with the co-op model that's very different than the big grocers is that the co-op model allows the people who are shopping at the store to be an owner in the store. And in doing so, the co-op is rooted in its community. It's centered in the community. It's headquartered in the community. And it's a lot more responsive to the needs of the community, whether it's the people producing food in the area or whether it's, you know, the nonprofit organizations that that grocery store, that co-op is supporting. So, you know, the idea with the book is to say, if we want to have a long-term grocery store that's rooted in our communities, the best model that I've certainly come across is the cooperative model. It's the one that can keep that grocery store headquartered locally.
And, of course, one of the things you write about in the book is the huge consolidation of the grocery store industry. That's not uncommon for a major grocer to have 15, 20 different stores around the country purporting all to be to sort of the beat of the local grocery store. But in fact, they're owned by a gigantic chain.
Well, this is it. So there are right now really just a shrinking number of large grocery giants, as I read about in the book. And underneath each of those companies are upwards of, like you say, a dozen, maybe even more banners. So these are the names that we'll see on the signage outside the store. But who actually owns that store or what company owns that store is often a mystery. And so one of the resources I create on my website for the book is a section called Who Owns Your Grocery Store? So it's a way for anybody to really get a sense of, okay, I'm shopping at this store here, who owns it and where are they located? And there are, like I say, a shrinking number of these companies. So as I read about in the book, about 67% of all of the grocery dollars being spent in the United States right now are ending up in the hands of only five companies. And that's increasing as many of these grocers are consolidating and acquiring other chains. Of course, one of the more well-known ones recently was Whole Foods being acquired by Amazon. So this was Amazon's first foray into brick-and-mortar stores, likely not their last. And so, you know, this is something that is an important question, I think, for eaters to be asking is who owns our grocery store? Because once we start looking at the answer to that question, we can see, you know, is this a company that's really operating in the interests of the local area? Is this a company that is supporting the people producing food? Are they trying to pressure those suppliers to sell it at the lowest possible price? And we're seeing more and more of this happen, this pressure and this limit that many food makers of all types, whether it's a farmer or a baker or an ice cream maker, there's a limit that these producers now have to selling food into the marketplace because there's a fewer number of chains and companies to sell to.
Let's talk a little bit about market share for grocery stores. I would think that maybe 20 years ago, before the co-op movement began growing significantly, I would say it was probably 95, 96%. And that would include your local grocery stores like the mom and pop stores, but they're still buying from the same distributors as, say, the bigger chains. What is the market share for co-ops versus grocery stores today and, say, 20 years ago?
Well, you know, to be honest, there probably hasn't been a very significant dent that co-ops have made in the market share across the country, mostly because at this point there are only 230 food co-ops. Some of those have multiple locations, so we're looking at about a little over 300 locations across the country, which is quite small when you have companies like Kroger and Walmart that are operating in the tens of thousands of locations. This is, you know, a small drop in the bucket right now that food co-ops are making. But that said, within local communities where there is a food co-op, so I can take my community where I live as an example, I live in a town of 10,000 people. We're a hub for about 20,000 people. And we have four large grocery stores. And three of them are owned by the three largest chains in Western Canada. And then there's our food co-op that has been growing to where it's at today for the past 45 years. And we estimate we have about 15 to 20% of our market right now, which is significant for a food co-op. So when co-ops do open up in communities, particularly in places where there might only be one or two chains operating, co-ops do have a great responsibility there and an opportunity to become, you know, a significant player in the grocery store market locally.
You talk about your co-op, which has been around, what, 40 years now or more?
Almost 45 years. We started in the 1970s, and there's many across the country. In fact, most of the established co-ops that have been around for some time started in this really small window of 1971 to about 1976, most of them in that 1974-75 era. There was this wave of interest in trying to create an alternative to the big food stores, and many formed as buying clubs. There were thousands of these really across the country. And at a certain point, though, because a lot of those buying clubs relied on the labor from the people who were members of those clubs, by the early 1980s, a lot of that volunteer capacity started to wane. And it was a time when food co-ops either really closed up and decided to move on, and others transformed into businesses, businesses with a management team. They started to offer, you know, a full-service line of groceries rather than, say, just bulk goods like many of those buying clubs started with. So our co-op was just like those other ones across the United States, where in the early 1980s, we opened up our first storefront, and we've been growing ever since, starting with, I think, three staff members in the first location, and now we have 175 employees working in our store. We are right now the largest non-governmental employer in our town and employing more people than any of the other grocers. So it's another great thing with food co-ops, because they're centered in their community. It means that the headquarters is in the community. It's in that store. So there's that many more jobs that that cooperatively owned grocery store is creating because of that, rather than have those decisions and those jobs being left in a headquarters in some distant city. These are jobs that are being left and kept and preserved in the communities that they're operating.
Now, the co-op you're describing, how would it differ from a grocery store as far as having a storefront that you could walk in the same way? What is the difference between a grocery store and, say, a co-op the way it's run in a place like your hometown in BC?
Well, our store is very reminiscent of a normal full-service grocery store. I mean, we're smaller than really those big ones that you'll see, probably half the size, if not less than a Whole Foods, for example. But co-ops take every form and size. And, you know, I've seen tiny little stores of 600 square feet and others that are upwards of 30,000 square feet. And the ones that seem to be the most successful in their communities that are really like making a big difference to the food system, you walk in and it feels like any other full-service grocery store. What you might notice that's different is what's on the shelves. So food co-ops mostly across the country are focusing their attention on providing as much local food as possible, organic foods, natural foods. But that's not synonymous with co-ops. So you might find a co-op like some of the ones I visited up here in the northeastern U.S. where I am right now that are offering a blend of familiar name brands as well as natural and organic foods. And, you know, those are stores that are also having a tremendous impact in their communities. They're contributing a lot more to their communities by supporting nonprofits. They're employing more people because they're headquartered in the communities. But they really do just look like any other grocery store as far as what's on the shelves. And then others are almost more reminiscent of a little market, a farm market, if you will, where you walk in and because almost everything on the shelves is local, you don't find recognizable food brands. And so it's really up to the communities that are operating these co-ops or thinking of starting one as to what they want their grocery store to be. And, yeah, they can look of every shape and every color and every size.
But for the most part, co-ops look like there is a storefront involved with it, as opposed to, say, a share program where a producer might actually sell shares of their produce locally. I think we see efforts like that here in northeastern Oklahoma, where, you know, you're seeing local producers who are, you know, going to the farmer's market, they're selling shares of their produce each, you know, and you get a bag full of that week's produce. Is that something different than a co-op?
That is different, yeah. So when food co-ops are, the language of food co-ops, when that's used, and this is what I write about in the book, is the focus are grocery stores that are cooperatively owned, whereas, you know, the programs you're describing, CSAs or community supported agriculture programs, you know, these aren't co-ops per se, but they're certainly in the spirit of co-ops in that the people eating, the people who are supporting that farm are investing in that farm at the beginning of the season and receiving a share of the produce that's coming off of that farm. So it's a different model, but there, you know, there are synergies between CSAs and food co-ops. Some of the examples I use are that the food co-op is a grocery store normally would look at a CSA or a farmer's market as competition. And in fact, many co-ops see them as synergistic with themselves. And so they'll create what some co-ops do, a CSA fair, where once a year you'll get all the different farms that are operating these CSAs to show up at the store and market their program for the summer or for the season to the members of that co-op, the grocery store shoppers. And so people at the store will sign up for their CSA and, like you mentioned, we'll get a weekly box of veggies and produce. And it's an interesting thing for a grocery store to create that space because it's actually taking business away from the co-op. But co-ops are actually seeing this as a benefit because many of those farmers that are operating CSAs might also be selling into the co-op. And so co-ops are seeing this as a way to support the same people that they're buying food from. And it's another great example of just the different relationships a cooperatively owned grocery store will form in their community versus, say, some of these large natural food stores or the big chains.
John Steinman is my guest today. He's the producer and host of Deconstructing Food and a director and president of his consumer co-op in Nelson, British Columbia, and the author of Grocery Story, The Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. It's published by New Society. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. The first part of the book actually goes through the whole history of grocery stores and supermarkets. And what was your big takeaway as you began researching how grocery stores got started and supermarkets got started and how they've moved to today? What was the big takeaway?
One of the big takeaways I took from that research was seeing a very different playing field, I guess you could say, within the food system 100 years ago, which is how far back I go with the history of grocery retailers. Some of the big chains were really starting to expand at that point. The early 1910s, you had a company like A&P, which had about 4,500 stores and growing rapidly. And so the playing field was very different then, where you had many independent grocery stores, very few chains emerging. And so food manufacturers, those companies that were producing breakfast cereal or what have you, even bread as a local bakery, you know, they had many customers to be selling into. A&P might have been one of them, but there were also hundreds, if not thousands, of other places to sell that product to. And so this left the people manufacturing food and producing food with a lot more power in the marketplace to determine the price that they needed for their product. So one of the examples I share in the book, which is a real, I think, important contrast to the climate of grocery retail today, is the example of Cream of Wheat, which was operating back then, producing breakfast cereal. And they were selling to A&P and to all of their other customers for 11 cents a box. They were selling their cereal. And what they did is they asked all of their customers, in order to create a level playing field, they asked their customers to sell that cereal on the shelf for 14 cents. And when A&P came in as a large chain grocer, a very new concept in the world at the time, they were able to use their volume purchasing and their power to say, you know what, we're going to buy this for 11 cents a box, but we're going to sell it for 12 cents. And they began undercutting all of the competition. And Cream of Wheat did something that very few manufacturers and suppliers of food could do today. They said, okay, well, that's not fair to our other customers. We're just going to stop selling our cereal to you, A&P. And A&P turned around and said, okay, well, that's restraint of trade, and took them to court, and A&P actually lost that case. Which is an example of the sentiment at the time, I think, to the fears of these chain grocers gaining too much power in the marketplace. Today, though, 100 years later, this same behavior is happening with these large grocers trying to push prices down, trying to push suppliers to sell to them at the cheapest possible price, changing payment terms, really practicing very ruthless behaviors. And it's not that easy for these suppliers today to be able to say, we're just going to stop selling to you, because there's only a handful of companies left to really sell product into. So that was one of my big takeaways, was really this very different playing field and different climate that existed 100 years ago.
You relate a story, which this has been in all sorts of products, from a large retailer to our immediate east in northwest Arkansas. Walmart.
You bet.
Was it Vlasic Pickles or another pickle manufacturer who wanted to get their pickles in Walmart, and they were literally selling those pickles at a loss. And when they complained about it, they said, well, fine, we'll just take all of your product out of our stores.
Exactly, and this is happening across the board now. Just a month ago, as I was traveling across from British Columbia to the northeastern U.S., where I am right now, Canada's second largest grocer, Sobeys, announced to all of its suppliers that they were changing their payment terms. So rather than pay back their suppliers in 30 days, which is quite standard in any industry, they decided to start paying their suppliers back in 60 days. And for some suppliers that would like to be paid back in 20 days, they were saying, we'll do that, but we need a 2% discount on all future invoices. So this is the pressure that these big grocers are now exerting in the food system. And it's something that many eaters, in fact, I'd say most eaters, are probably completely unaware of. In fact, that news really just hit Canada's media because one of the suppliers decided to go to the media and share what was happening. So this is something I'm trying to bring awareness to in the book, that these are the practices we're seeing. And there's a lot of us out there who care about the future of farming and the future of good food. And I think these are important things to be aware of for us who care about this.
So one of the things your book does is talk about the benefit of a co-op to a food producer, you know, somebody who's growing produce, who's creating sustainable beef or a lamb or pork, you know, trying to do the right thing, become organic. Can you talk about the difference in payout if they were to sell to a traditional distributor that would distribute to big chains as opposed to going the co-op route? What's their payback?
Well, you know, co-ops are really in the business of supporting local producers of all kinds with what they need in order to sustain their businesses. And of course, at the end of the day, it also matters and depends on the people who are shopping at those stores to purchase those foods and be willing to pay the price. So co-ops aren't pressuring their suppliers to, you know, sell to them at the cheapest possible price. They're saying, what is it you need? And here's what we're going to make sure we sell this product at so we can pay you what you need. So that's a very different relationship right there. And what many co-ops are also doing, particularly with some of these up-and-coming businesses, is they'll be working with them intimately to say, you know, here's what we think is going to work on the shelf as far as your branding. They'll actually place that food at eye level on the shelf to really promote it to the people who are walking down the aisles, which is not something we see in the big grocers, where that eye level shelf space is actually being sold to the manufacturers, whoever can pay the highest price through what's known as slotting fees. So co-ops are really going above and beyond to say, we're going to create space for you, we're going to make sure this product is in front of our customers, and we're going to pay you what you need. And at our co-op in British Columbia, we have two people employed in what we call our True Local program that's actually working with these startup businesses in trying to support them and almost offering the type of advice you'd expect to get from a business consultant. It's coming right from the store itself.
So are the produce producers or the meat producers, are they getting a different price, or are you're giving them a sense of volume, or what?
Well, you know, I can't speak specifically to what some of the stores are paying some suppliers versus, say, co-ops, but I know of the suppliers I interviewed for the book, they're generally finding the relationship with the co-ops a lot more financially lucrative because they're getting paid what they need. They're not getting pressured into selling at a lower price. But, you know, like I say, it really comes down to what is it that the consumer, the shopper, is willing to pay. And I do think that suppliers of food products are benefiting more significantly by selling into a co-op. And there's also this balancing act of trying to also offer a price that people are willing to pay. And I think some of it comes down to really education of really understanding what does it take to produce this food and what does it cost and how much should we be paying in order to sustain that farm.
Now, one of the things we've seen from grocery stores in the recent years has been an acknowledgement that some of the attraction of co-op, CSAs, where it's, you know, guaranteed organic produce, no hormones, all the typical things, issues that are going into local food and how consumers are examining the foods they eat, you're seeing grocery stores respond to that. Has that made any difference on a co-op level to have the co-ops that are existing now?
I think it has. You know, co-ops were once, particularly those that are focused more on this alternative food system of offering organic foods and local foods. I think whereas once co-ops were operating in a niche alongside natural food retailers and Whole Foods perhaps, that's no longer the case because a lot of these chains, a lot of the big grocers are starting to carry these types of products as well. The organic food economy is a great example where in the late 90s, early 2000s, all the big grocers were getting into it, and it really transformed the entire food system. And so co-ops are in a very different place today than they were even 15, 20 years ago. And it's a new climate to be operating in, particularly when, as some of the examples I share in the book, you have these big grocers that are latching on to these ideas of, for example, local food and taking that name local and starting to expand the definition of what local means. There's a lot of, I think, sloppiness that's happening within that realm right now. Whereas, you know, the co-ops are really trying to maintain some integrity within that label local. And so some of the examples I've been sharing on my book tour over the past month, one is a large grocery giant out of Michigan, Meijer, that has been promoting their relationships with what they call local farmers, but their local definition is an entire six-state region. So extending all the way from Wisconsin down to Illinois, Ohio, Kentucky, Michigan, and Indiana, and they've decided that for them, this is what local means. And so that's a very different local than what I think many would understand at a farmer's market or at a food co-op. And so co-ops are now competing with this new definition of local. And
I'm looking at a picture in your book where it says, I believe it looks like there are some apples there, and it says, produced in Western Canada.
Exactly. So that's a photo in the book from a Safeway store in Nelson, British Columbia, where I live. And our Safeway in Canada is owned by Sobeys, one of the largest grocers in the country. And yeah, they've expanded the definition of local to the entire western portion of the country, which is actually contravening Canadian labeling laws. So in some places in Canada and even in the U.S., there are labeling laws that say you can't call a product local unless it comes from within a defined geographic area. And so in Canada, it's actually quite broad. It was expanded back in 2014 to include an entire province, which is another challenge, of course, that challenges the local definition. But here in this picture, you see that one company has expanded local to the entire western portion of the country, which is in contravention of that labeling law. And there are examples of this happening all across the country. I walked into a grocery store here in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where I am right now, a Wegmans owned by the Wegman family in Rochester, New York. They've got well over 100 stores now, and they have a program called From Family Farms Near Our Stores, and they'll put this labeling across products that are from the area. And there was one I came across yesterday, a cheese, right on top of a sign that said From Family Farms Near Our Stores, and it was from all the way in Wisconsin, nowhere near Pennsylvania. And so this is happening in every store. You don't have to stake out the store to find the to find the mistakes or to find the disingenuous marketing. It's happening everywhere.
The name of the book is Grocery Story, Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. You can see more of John Steinman's work on his podcast and television web series titled Deconstructing Food. John, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
John Steinman is a Canadian food systems journalist and the author of Grocery Story, The Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. It's published by New Society. That's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.